Welcome to Podopticon. I'm Randall Hendrickson. Montaigne's essays and Montaigne himself are the twin themes of this episode. Really, the two are hard to separate. As Montaigne puts himself, warts and all, center stage. Warts and all. You might say that Montaigne's self-deprecation is insincere or ironic. Rousseau thought something like this. Or better to say, when Rousseau is writing his own confessions, he means to give you some full and true portrait of an individual, whereas Montaigne presents mostly his most charming foibles. There's something to that. While he's self-deprecating from the start, he is pretty impressed with a number of his own qualities, and he doesn't mind saying so in his own way. My guest is Douglas Thompson. He's the author of the excellent Montaigne and the Tolerance of Politics. And he draws out this aspect of the essays in an enlightening way by showing what's political in Montaigne's great work, where we find Montaigne recommending himself as a very fine ambassador indeed, for instance. I highly recommend Thompson's book in turn. I learned a lot from it and from our conversation. Montaigne started writing the essays in 1571 and carried on for the next nearly 20 years. I think he didn't so much edit as add stuff, inserting bits here and there or adding whole new essays. In the end, the work comes to 107 essays across three books. We know the dates when things were added, and we can work out certain events alluded to by considering the dates of composition. Or that's one way to read Montaigne. As Thompson himself notes, it would be a bit of a literary crime against Montaigne to try to make too much of one thing out of him or of his work. Montaigne comes across as a yes-sayer, a both-and kind of thinker, as we note in the episode. If he is consistently one thing, it's anti-cruelty. His humanity sparkles throughout the essays. Montaigne is unsystematic, too, which I think is attractive, and wonder if it's a reason he's been so dear to so many readers. Now, since I don't really know how to begin talking about Montaigne or how to justify an episode devoted to him, I'll just be a bit self-indulgent and talk about what I, as a more casual reader, have taken from him. Just my thoughts, then. Please don't let them turn you off the essays. For no particular reason, even arbitrarily, I'll dwell a bit on this aspect of his appeal for me. I found Montaigne to be an excellent example of a thinker who doesn't have use for nature in the sense of natural law. That's to say, there's nothing in Montaigne about nature that we can consult for how we ought to live. To pull that off would, for one thing, require a remarkable act of reasoning. But Montaigne devoted a whole long essay, The Apology of Raymond Savant, to dismantling trust in the workings of reason and its two variable conclusions. It's a fascinating text in its own right. Anyway, references to human nature or natural law have always felt a bit heavy-handed to me, since I don't know how one might discern such a thing, at least in the ordinary philosophical sense of providing a guide to how one ought to live. Montaigne makes this reader feel like a fellow traveler on this point, then. There's a blurred line between nature and custom in his work that I find intriguing. He doesn't take the step of trying to peel away at custom to arrive at something like bedrock nature. He leaves that thought experiment to others and dwells on life as he and we live it. Now, though I've said he has no use for natural law in the ordinary sense, one immediately has to add that he does refer to living according to nature as some kind of standard, which is to say he doesn't dispose of the vocabulary of nature. But I think it might be easy enough, with some digression, to see what he means. One of Montaigne's intentions seems to be to evince appreciation of ordinary life and living. As Pierre Menant puts it in his book, Montaigne, Life Without Law, it is life itself in its ordinary tenor, in the variation of its humors and the irregularity of its accidents that needs to be brought to light and installed in a light that causes its fullness to appear, while preserving its imperfection. As an aside, I wonder if this might be one role of Montaigne's self-deprecating style. to keep imperfection front and center. Montaigne's unfolding of the flux and chaos of life is grounds for his rejection of older versions of how one ought to live. It's all to be replaced with a new priority, becoming aware of your own self in light of life's ordinary accidental character. This edges out a search for the beautiful or the good, which some may regret, and brings a certain nonchalance to living, and even nonchalance to what some consider fundamental questions of life, like is there a God? What about an afterlife? What is the good life? And so on, which some might find troublesome too. There's no ground for judgment, really, in rational criteria that tell us somehow about how we ought to live. There's no set of principles or virtues we must consult. There are admirable things, of course, but no one life usually contains all of them. The varied figures Montaigne admires, Cato, Socrates, Pyrrho, a peasant from Armagnac, La Boétie, Lucretius, and others, do exhibit certain qualities that Montaigne seems consistently to find impressive and admirable. As Raymond Goyce has noted, these include wherewithal in the face of pain, bearing adversity without complaint, unpretentiousness, consistency of action and thought, and so on. But again, none of Montaigne's models has all of these qualities, and likely neither will I. Or so that seems a possible message. And so as no one life usually contains all such qualities, a reader is turned inward. Montaigne encourages one not to go looking too far beyond oneself for how one ought to live. Don't go trying to emulate heroes and saints. And again, there's no point in consulting natural law here. So what to do? It's to learn to be yourself by getting to know yourself, which is the thing that doesn't change but rather has what Montaigne calls a master form. So back to that strange recommendation for one who rejects natural law as normally understood. Let life be lived according to nature. What can that possibly mean in this context? It turns out that one lives according to nature within the bounds of custom. Recall I referred to the blurring of the line between nature and custom. Nature is not to be distinguished so starkly from custom because it turns out that so much of what we consider natural is something that's extremely bound up with custom to begin with. And what makes for that nature/custom is distinct across a variety of times and places. Montaigne, for instance, refers to his speaking Latin as natural to him, when we know full well his education to the language was anything but natural. Life according to nature is a life not ruled according to certitudes or set principles. Indeed, Montaigne calls such a life the most stupid in his essay of experience. But as I intimated, living according to nature isn't for Montaigne living contrary to the laws, customs, and habits of one's own place. Nature is lived within the realm of habit and custom. Indeed, in the end, it seems that living according to nature amounts to the following. I quote from Goyce's book, Changing the Subject, which captures it all quite well. Living according to nature means not to impose on one's life a model of living which one has come to know through some kind of cognitive insight and which is utterly at odds with local customs. As Goyce points out, one might object that this view is too quietistic or conformist in the end. But whatever you think, you can't claim that it's a natural law view in any sense. And I find that all quite interesting, even appealing. So much for that. These are simply some of my impressions of a long and varied book, so don't take my word for anything, really. Do have a listen, though, as we're guided by Thompson's expertise. I very much enjoyed my conversation with him, and I can't recommend his book enough. Again, it's titled Montaigne and the Tolerance of Politics. Now to the episode. Douglas Thompson, welcome to Podopticon.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Randall.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. We're going to talk about Montaigne, so we're lucky to have the author of Montaigne and the Tolerance of Politics with us. Anybody who's read Montaigne would know, or would probably sympathize with my being at a loss for where to begin. So I'll do that little trick where you kind of begin at the beginning and say that, you know, even though Montaigne seems to put himself on full display on the one hand, on the other, and this might be part of his charm, he doesn't so explicitly highlight what we might call the high points of his life and career. So I wonder if at the start you can give us a sketch of Montaigne's upbringing and his later involvement in political affairs. I mean, we'll say more about political affairs as we move along, but I wonder if you could give us a sort of thumbnail sketch of the guy we're dealing with here.
Montaigne is born in 1533, which is the same year that Queen Elizabeth is born in England. And he's born into a recently ennobled merchant family. So his family had purchased the lands of Montaigne outside of Bordeaux. And as a result, they're kind of, you know, insecurely a noble family, very, very recent, as every other noble family would know. And Pierre Riquem has the father of Montaigne, has a very unique and idiosyncratic plan for educating his son, which pays huge dividends in the end with the essays. And so when it comes time for Montaigne to be raised at home with, of course, household staff and wet nurses and all of this, Pierre Riquem hires people who only speak Latin. He actually hires a German nurse who can't speak French, nice, but can speak Latin. And so Montaigne's first language isn't French, it's Latin.
Yeah.
And so this is a way to get a leg up on other people and other possible competitors in the future, you know, who are going to be speaking this really important lingua franca of the educated classes throughout Europe. Right. And so Montaigne ends up a fantastic Latinist. Pierre Riquem also sends Montaigne in for a time to go live in villages around Montaigne, to live with peasants, and so to adopt and to kind of understand the ordinary customs of regular people. Because after all, as a landowner and as someone who's going to be employing people in the peasantry to work on their large wine estates, because it's a Bordeaux business after all, right, Montaigne will adopt or at least understand how to be with ordinary people, not just with elite folks. But then he also has this elite education. He's sent off to the College of Guienne, where he learns from top-notch, internationally known at this point, humanist scholars like George Buchanan. And at some point after this, he gets legal training, law training. You can see it in his work, but we don't quite know where or how that happened. And then he, as a younger man, he takes on various roles within different parts of the Parliament of Bordeaux. He takes on, which is a very common thing for a young nobleman to do. Actually, Montesquieu, centuries later, will have a very similar role in the very same regional parliament. And those parliaments they're more like administrative and law courts. They're not elected legislative, institutions like we would use the word parliament today. And there's like 13 of them around France at this time. They have relative autonomy in some cases, to push back against what the king wants. So Montaigne has this experience for some time. And then in the early 1570s, he retires from the Parliament of Bordeaux, retreats to his chateau, and embarks on this literary project where he starts writing the essays. And he has a bunch of stuff to say about why he does this, but there seems to be a whole, as always with Montaigne, there's a whole variety of purposes and motivations, all of which happen at the same time together, and that he's perfectly happy to enunciate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talk about big events that don't get special essays, he's born in the wake of the Reformation and beginning in 1560, 62, something like this, the French Wars of Religion, which will continue through his life if I have the dates right, he takes place in an explosive context. And, as we'll, hear more and more, his career, takes place in, really the highest kinds of circles.
on both ends, on the Catholic and Protestant, and in a mm-hmm. sort of region riven. I mean, from what I understand, there was a large Protestant population where he was.
Yeah, yeah. So he's in the southwest of France, and he's very close, therefore, to the Kingdom of Navarre, which is a sort of, you know, the borderlands of Spain and France. And so, you know, the French Wars of Religion are, you know, they're battles and fights over, you know, which religion will be dominant, which version of Christianity will be dominant in France, whether it'll be a sort of Calvinist version of Protestantism or the, you know, Roman Catholic Church. And it's largely a fight between noble families. And so that's the main motivation. So as with so many wars, quote unquote, wars of religion, there's here again, a huge mix of motives. You know, if you capture someone else's territory, that's your territory now with all the rents that come with it. So there's economic motivations. There's dynastic motivations. You know, what if our line of one of these noble families can become the royal line by, you know, killing those folks. So there's dynastic motivations, there's economic motivations, there are genuine religious motivations. But all of this stuff swirls together in this really unstable, you know, moment. It lasts almost, you know, 40 years in France. And it really, you know, Montaigne begins writing after the first 10 years of this. And he writes continuously from, well, actually with a break while he's mayor of Bordeaux for the early 1580s. Mm-hmm. But he writes, you know, other than that, continuously from 1571 up to his death in 1592. And so the essays we have is a 20-year long document from his life, but also, you know, that includes references, sometimes explicit, sometimes slightly veiled, to events that are happening throughout all of this.
Yeah. So the book that issues from that interesting and peculiar life is simply called the Essays. What's the meaning of essay?
Yes, and he's the first person to use it in this way. And so when we talk about like writing a college essay, you know, we're kind of borrowing from his usage as a single, you know, document. Uh-huh. The word was in use at his time, but it meant sort of an attempt. Mm-hmm. Or a try, or like a taste. Let's see what this idea does. And what he does is he just does, you know, in the end, 1,200 pages of these, and he puts them together in this big document of him trying ideas out. And I think, you know, one of the things that I would absolutely say to listeners is, I've been doing scholarly work on the essays, but there's so many ways of approaching the book. And there's so many ways that Montaigne even says, as he's writing, you know, that how one might approach his book. And there's so many legitimate ways to read the book. It's not a book that you have to do intensive scholarly research to understand anything at all of it. It's meant to be enjoyed, too. I mean, he says this, and clearly he's enjoying it. Right? I think one of the reasons why the book, it's one of the most widely read books in human history over the last, you know, almost 500 years. Right. And I think one of the reasons for this is because, like, the joy of trying out all these different kinds of ideas is, you know, really tangible in the text. And I don't think anybody that I've ever met, myself included, has ever, like, opened the essays and read from page one to page 1200 whatever. Right. You just got to pick it up and you're like, oh, I haven't thought, oh, there's an essay of thumbs. Let's find out what he has to say about thumbs. Of smells. Oh, what does he have to say about smells? You know, and the titles often don't really match what he writes about in each of the individual chapters because he'll get distracted. You know, he'll go off on some flight of fancy and he'll come back to what he was originally saying. Yeah. And the themes kind of, you know, important themes sort of weave discontinuously throughout different chapters of the book. And so, you know, you can just pick it up and enjoy it at face value. Or if you're a nerd like I am, you can get really excited about all the different mysteries and the question of like, which event is he talking about in this particular chapter? Uh-huh. You can do all that stuff too. And he's one of these people who invites you to read his book in a number of different ways. One of my favorite passages of the book is, I forget which chapter it's in, but he basically says, you know, look, I write about absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can do whatever you want with all of that. In fact, he says, you know, I have put throughout all of these essays the seeds of other possible essays that the reader can pick up and carry for themselves. So you don't have to do, you know, detailed historical research just to understand right. what's going on. You just pick it up, run with it, make these ideas your own. You know, that's what he even announces. You know, he wants readers to do.
That's totally how I've read it. I can say I've read the essays, but it wasn't from beginning to end at the start.
Same here. I don't know anyone who has.
It's a matter of curiosity, you know. I mean, and I would only add that he draws you in by making you feel like you're a friend along for the ride, you know. And he has a real knack for that, putting you in that position. Now the book itself, as we know from various editorial artifices, is it's composed in stages, right?
Yes.
And this turns out to be useful to know, and it's often useful to the argument of your book, if I have it right. Can you talk about these various layers of composition?
Certainly, and they all have a relationship to different parts of his political career too, which I think obviously I stress in the book, but there's other things you could stress too, right? And so the first edition of the essays, he starts writing 1571, and the first edition of the essays gets printed by a local Bordeaux printer. He brings it himself, and I think on his own dime, his own centime. that was later French currency. Never mind, but his own sou. he has it. If we're going to be precise, he has it printed by this local printer, and he has, I forget how many copies exactly, but a few hundred maybe. And so this comes out in 1580. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things he does is he takes this 1580 essays, and one of the important things to note about this is that the 1580 essays is structured very differently from the later editions that'll come out. It consists of two books of chapters, or two books of essays, however you want to call them. And I forget the exact number at that point, but you have two books of various chapters. And the books are at this point are about a lot of idiosyncratic stuff, like the of smells and all that sort of thing. Right. But they're also about a lot of a sort of mainstream humanist political writing stuff at the time. Uh-huh. There are questions of political decision making. How should ambassadors behave? how do kings act when they're in a negotiation with each other? All of that sort of thing. And so he presents this 1580 edition to the king, Henry III, whom he doesn't know yet. He had known Henry's older brother, Charles IX. Okay. All of these French kings, by the way, in rapid succession, are the sons of Catherine de Medici, the daughter rather of Lorenzo de Medici, to whom Machiavelli dedicates the prince. Right. So this is pan-European stuff going on there. Yeah. But so he brings the essays to Henry III as kind of a means of introduction. And Philippe Dizon has argued, and I build on his argument. I'm heavily indebted to his work here, that he's basically bringing this as a kind of CV to Henry, saying, hey, look, this is who I am. This is how my judgment looks. I know all of this humanist stuff that political advisors and diplomats are have to know according to the established literatures of our time. Yeah. Look how well I do that stuff. Not only that, but I injected my own personality into this book quite a lot. If you know who you're getting if you hire me.
Right.
And so he immediately goes off and does this tour in. He goes through Switzerland and Germany, and then down to Rome, possibly on a diplomatic mission. Uh-huh. And while he's in Rome, he's informed that he has been elected by the Council of Jura, they're called, in Bordeaux, that he's been elected mayor of Bordeaux, a post that his father had also held in the past. Okay. So he comes back, serves as mayor of Bordeaux, and as mayor of Bordeaux, he's in this, as you said a second ago, he's in this area in southwest France that it has huge Protestant populations, and of course the long-standing Catholic populations. Montaigne himself is, by reading anyway, is a committed Catholic, and says so over and over again. And so his assignment is basically not just to manage the affairs of the city of Bordeaux, but to help keep the peace between these potentially warring parties, between the Protestant armies of Henry of Navarre and the Protestant villagers and the Catholic villagers. And so he serves as mayor of Bordeaux until 1585. Mm-hmm. And then his political career, at least that aspect of it, is over. Okay. And this is when he starts to revise the essays. And so all of a sudden, all these new political themes based on his recent political experience as a high level, in some cases, negotiator, and right. sometimes as a low level negotiator, between armies, you know, leaders and all this, between the Protestants and Catholics, basically in his region. And what he does and the way he edits the first volume is fascinating. And I don't know any other author who does this or has ever done this. He basically, for this edition that will come out in 1588, he adds a new third book with 13 chapters that are typically longer than most of the chapters of the other book. And to all of the already existing chapters of those first two books that came out in 1580, he intersperses hundreds and hundreds of new passages. Sometimes they're just a sentence long, sometimes they're several pages long. And he doesn't announce where these new passages go. And sometimes he contradicts what he wrote in the previous passage. And as he says explicitly, you know, I don't erase anything, I just add. I'm just adding to the book. Right. And so already in the 1580 edition of the essays, you've got all of these arguments on both sides of multiple questions without resolution. Already in the 1580 edition of the essays, you've got these long digressions where he'll be talking about some important political matter, and then he'll go off on a tangent about, you know, sometimes pretty, you know, humorous stuff. And so then if you add into all that already, you know, sort of mad complexity, hundreds of new passages that in some cases contradict what you said in the previous sentence without any explanation at all. Part of the sort of the chaos, if you want to put it in those terms, part of the appeal, I think, of the book is just all of these ideas in there. And he's very, very comfortable contradicting himself without explanation and any need to resolve it, because he's dealing with complex matters. And so the 1588 edition of the essays comes out. It's printed by a much larger Paris printer, and this is where it gets diffused. He also, there's sort of pirate printings that had happened before with the 1580 essays. He's beginning to gain, sort of by accident, he says, you know, it wasn't what he was expecting, a broader European reading audience. Okay. And he's very aware of this public audience. And then he immediately, when the 1588 edition comes out, he starts making even more additions to that. And so he dies in 1592 before that, you know, other edition is finished. It's been published posthumously. And we can see his editorial style. If you ever look, and you can find pictures of this online, he writes in ink in the margins of the 1588 edition, all of the passages he wants to add in. They're just written all over the place, with stuff, some words crossed out, and carrots pointing to new passages in the middle of a sentence. Yeah, and so if you see like his actual editorial practice, he called these new passages allongailles, or elongations of the text. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. So, you know, you can actually see his thinking process. But
right.
I mean, when you're reading the essays for scholarly reasons, and you don't have to do it this way to enjoy them by any stretch, but for my purposes, you know, you have to take into consideration all of this stuff.
Exactly.
And I think one of the pitfalls that it's easy to fall into is to find a set of opinions in the essays that support something you want to, you know, talk about, and to say, oh, this is Montaigne's opinion, without taking into consideration the fact that he's going to argue against himself, you know, multiple times in other chapters, and not just two opinions, but sometimes a third and a fourth opinion will come around without any explanation or resolution. And so, you know, one of the tricky parts, and I think the book took longer to write for this reason, is that, you know, how do you account for all that? And what is he saying? If he often is hard to, you know, nail down what his single opinion is, you know, what is he doing then? You know, and it's a sort of an open, fun game to play while reading, to be honest.
It is an open, fun game to play, and I could sort of jump. You do play the game a bit in your book by discussing a style of argument he has, which is to take up both sides in a very sort of serious way. So, you know, the question, of course, is what do you do with that? You know, I mean, it's his tendency, right, to say something like, how does he put it? You know, he'll be building an argument and then abruptly say, now onto another vat. You know, or something like that.
Yes.
Or now something from another vat, or however he puts it, you know, something like this. So you make something of this style, which has a fancy Latin term. So maybe we talk about that just a bit more.
Sure. And so one of the arguments in the book is that, you know, I think more than, you know, perhaps we had acknowledged previously, the actual form of the book is heavily indebted to a lot of political writing styles that were, you know, really predominant at the time that he's writing. So, you know, a lot of cases, you know, the essays have been have been identified as a kind of anti or apolitical book, but the actual form of the text is very, is itself comes from, you know, European political cultures of the time. And what I mean is this, you know, one of the main forms of writing genres, and I should say before getting into that, that the essays being its own unique genre, it basically it's a mashup of, so it doesn't come from nowhere. He borrows from a giant host of existing writing genres, not so much like philosophical treatises, which exist at the time. He doesn't want to write like that, obviously. Right. That sort of systematic art, you know, building the arguments right. Slowly. He's certainly not into that. But he just borrows from a number of existing genres, whether it's, you know, Augustine's Confessions, right? There's a whole lot of confessional stuff in there. Mm-hmm. Although Augustine confesses for the sake of repentance, whereas Molyneux says, I never repent. Yeah. You know,
he has doubts about repentance.
He does have very, very big doubts. He's like, I'm not going to repent. Yeah, sure. I did that then. I do this now. Oh, well. So there's that, you know, there's epistolary, you know, literature. Mm-hmm. He dedicates some essays to certain people. But some of the genres that he really draws on a lot are counsel or advice book literature that was very prevalent part, perhaps the dominant form of political writing in the Renaissance. Yeah. And you have advice books for princes for how they can conduct their affairs in effective and morally good ways. If, you know, maybe not so much for Machiavelli, but for other examples. Yeah. Huge advice books for how to educate young men. And this is a very highly gendered culture. And we can talk about Montaigne and gender, because there's a lot to say there, too.
Sure.
You know, how to educate young men into being political, you know, counselors to kings, or how to be good courtiers, how to serve at courts, or how to be good ambassadors. It's a new literature that's just emerging at this time. So he borrows heavily from the advice book literature, and he also borrows heavily from the political education literature that is sort of a subgenre of that, and how to educate young people to be, you know, good, effective political leaders, counselors, ambassadors, etc. And so one of the main exercises in that those training manuals effectively is how do you wield persuasive speech effectively? If you want to, if you're going to be, you know, a counselor to princes and kings at court, one of the most important roles, by the way, in a monarchy, you have to have good, honest counsel if you're a ruler. Yeah. You have to have persuasive speech. How are you going to persuade a young nobleman who's like, you know, high on his own power? You know, how are you going to persuade this person to do right? You know, to make horrible blunders because they're going to overestimate themselves. Well, you have to build this huge copia. As in Latin, this kind of cornucopia of ideas and styles of speech. And one of the main exercises you do to get there is to get in the habit of doing written exercises and also oral exercises, arguing important questions from both sides.
Yeah.
And so you can argue for and against, for and against. And this is like, you know, Montaigne would have been intensely familiar with this practice at the College of Guienne as a young man, learning the law. And when he was serving in the Parliament of Bordeaux, especially when he early on, some of his lower level jobs before he rose up a bit more, he would have been given briefs of court cases and been told, you know, by the people who are going to judge these cases, I would like you to write up some information about this case, arguing both sides, because we want to know how to make this. So this is deeply imbued, this political practice in the Parliament of Bordeaux, this political education practice for how do you become an effective, Renaissance political actor. This is a deep part of who he is, and it's all over the essays. He very intentionally will make arguments on one side or another. The one you just referenced is one of my favorites. One of his favorite topics is, oh my goodness, what do we do with the great power of custom and habit in human life? If we're guided mostly by mere habit, mere custom, inherited ideas, are we in charge of anything at all? What do we do about this? Right. It's a great question. By the way, he popularizes this question, and it becomes sort of an obsession for 17th century thinkers, largely from reading Montaigne. They all read Montaigne for the reasons that we all read Montaigne, because he's delightful. And so he'll argue, we have to break free. We have to use reason and rational power to break free from the power of custom. And he argues this in one of the chapters for several pages. And, custom is this horrible, abusive schoolmistress that forces us to do stuff that we wouldn't want to do otherwise. Yeah. And he goes in and makes a big persuasive argument that human reason is the way to go. And then he all of a sudden says, you say, here's something from another vat. In other words, here's wine from another barrel. And he says, actually, the best thing we can do is to follow custom, because if we try to break out of it, disaster will ensue. And at the end of the chapter, he doesn't say, okay, here's what I really think. No, he just puts these two things out there, and that's that. And that argument happens in almost, not every chapter, but almost every chapter in various forms throughout the whole book with all kinds of other, alongside other similar arguments on both sides of various questions. So that's one feature of the book, that the very form of the book is formed shaped by, political training, political experience. And then the other thing he says, especially in later editions, and the later editions are again really interesting, because now he's reflecting much more on his direct higher level political experience as a negotiator. And we would also want to be very clear that he was negotiating in some cases with Henry of Navarre, the future Henry IV of France. So in some cases, it's very high level negotiation stuff. We wouldn't want to overestimate, though, his effect on the French Wars of Religion. He had a very important role, and he was certainly, we have record of him stopping a local conflict in many cases. But it's not thanks to Montaigne, the Wars of Religion ended. He's not that important, but he was regionally, locally, he was involved in important stuff. So then what starts to happen is he starts talking about, he redoubles his efforts to talk about himself and his own mind, and to portray, in some cases, not all, but to portray himself and his own mind as a self in flux, and a mind in constant motion and constant development. And to tie this in some chapters, to tie this to his experience as a negotiator, and to just as he had done in the first edition of the essays, where he kind of touts his special capacity to argue on both sides of cases, and then, as he says, to submit to the decisions of someone more qualified than myself, and I can't help but speak the truth, so I'm not a flatterer. He's advertising his unique capacities as a counselor and advisor to princes. And then he brings the book to Henry III to say, look, this is what you'll get if you hire me. And he effectively does get hired, as mayor of Bordeaux. We could say that the book works. Well, in the 1588 and then the post-1588 editions, he starts to talk about his capacity, uniquely wonderful capacities as a negotiator. And to tie this again with his analysis of himself.
So this... You want to say that the book's political, but that requires, as you say, something of a gestalt shift, right, to view the essays this way. The simple Why so? I mean, I think I understand this right as a reader who's taken Montaigne always to be a sort of skeptic, right, of the highest order, whose right. work was kind of, I don't know, deliberately disordered in the face of world flux, you know. You know, he says somewhere that others form men while he merely tells of them, you know, something like this. But I still want to know, why does it require thinking differently to think of Montaigne politically?
Ah, that's a great question. I think one of the reasons is the reception of Montaigne in the scholarship, that the for a long time, the majority, not all certainly, and I'm very much building on and explicitly so on previous recent research by other scholars, Renaissance scholars and Montaigne scholars and historians of political ideas and political theorists, you know, very explicitly building on some ideas of others on this. But there's a growing emphasis on political themes in the essays. And a growing emphasis on, you know, on some of the biographical stuff too, and how that enters into the essay. So I mentioned Philippe Dizon, but Bianca Maria Fontana has an excellent book on this. Gérald Nacon was a French scholar, sort of the earlier pioneer in writing about Montaigne's politics. There's multiple other people too. And I would definitely say, when I say, you know, Montaigne's book is a political book, what I'm saying is, that there's all of these political inputs that affect the very form of the text itself, and there's all of these, you know, pretty determinate political messages that he's trying to get out to public readership. But I would absolutely say that all what I'm saying is these are some of the inputs into the essays. Sure. It would be a crime to Montaigne to say that the book is about X and not Y, that he is A but not B. One of the great joys of this book is it's all of that stuff at once. You know, he says yes to all of it. So if we were to say, are the essays an ethical reflection on the meaning of the construction of the self and creating a meaningful life for one's own personal benefit, I would say absolutely the essays are about that. Yeah. Yes, of course. All I'm saying is, oh, look, and there's also all of this political stuff that's not just him talking about the politics of his time, but actually his own political experience affects the very form of the text, just as so many other forms of experience do. So, for example, I mentioned Augustine's Confessions. Sure. That's not a political book. I mean, I guess you could make arguments about that, but you know, it's not immediately obvious that that's what Augustine is doing right there. Well, Montaigne definitely is borrowing from Augustine's writing style. That's a part of the book too. And I would say that yes, there are a book that came out a little bit before mine, an excellent book called Montaigne and the Life of Freedom by Felicity Green. I highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, this isn't really a political book. And she highly emphasizes Montaigne's cultivation and argument for a kind of personal inner freedom as an ethical matter. Right. And so you have this ethical, personal, like inner freedom Montaigne in her book. Yeah. You have the political action, you know, political events and political themes and political, you know, genres in my book. Yes. And they're both right. I would never say, oh, that, you know, no, he's political. She's saying he's ethical. Yeah. Like Montaigne invites us not to do that. It's always like both and with him. Precisely. And never either or. And I think I think it's also one of the reasons why people love this book so much. He says yes so much more than he says no. And actually Nietzsche, who also loves yes saying, is like Montaigne's his favorite author. He says, you know, the only Nietzsche hates everybody. So the only author he ever consistently praises is Montaigne, because he says, you know, he even says like this guy says yes to everything. Yeah. This writer makes it worth living. It makes life worth living. You know, and that is Montaigne.
Yeah. Yeah. And even though Montaigne's willing to call himself uniquely capable, right, as a negotiator, he's also self-deprecating right from the start.
Enormously so.
Yes. Enormously self-deprecating. What's the role of that in his work? What does it do for him?
Yes, it's a great question. It starts with when he's talking about his unique capacities as a political counselor, when he says, you know, I have this uniquely broad, capacious form of judgment where I can see important, very difficult, complicated questions from multiple sides, And I can also then, you know, eventually you have to make a decision. I can submit to the decisions of my betters and then, you know, and follow them. You know, one of the conventions of the political counsel genre is you can't have presumption. You can't have presumption because that will lead you to give false advice and to want to flatter the you know political rulers, leaders, you know that you're working with and for, and so it's essential to present yourself as relatively humble. And so Montaigne plays this game throughout the essays, and it's actually hilarious. Once you see what he's doing, it's really funny. Yeah. He'll say things like, "Oh, I'm like," he'll even say directly, for example, I'm thinking in the chapter of presumption, he'll say, "You know, my judgment, I can never come to a single judgment. I'm all over the place with my judgments, and this is terrible for negotiating politically. This is terrible for a life of political activity." You know, and you actually, you know what's lacking in the French court today? Oh, it's people with broad judgment and people who can tell the truth to their princes. Look at the French court with all those liars. Unlike me at the French court. Imagine me at the French court. Right? Yeah. So it's like, wait a minute. You just say that you're terrible at this stuff. And then he quickly turns it without announcing it to like, and because I'm bad at all this stuff, like those other people who are doing a bad job, you know, I look what a great job I would do. He does the same thing with this thing. In the first book of new chapters that he adds in that later edition on the useful of the honorable. Again, really interesting that what does he do with that first new chapter? Mm-hmm. He goes right into political themes and he goes right into his own, you know, political work as a negotiator. Yeah. There he says, "Oh, I did a little bit of negotiating over the last few years. I am," this is a direct quote, I was a tender and novice negotiator, not as effective as those professional negotiators over there. And some of my flaws are that I can't help but tell the truth." Oh, you know, that's not very good in negotiations, is it? The other thing is that I'm, of course, a committed Catholic, but it's very easy for me to talk to both sides equally well. I can talk to both sides very well. In fact, few people have passed between different armed camps with as much freedom and welcome than I have. So he starts off by saying, I don't know any. I'm just a novice at this. I don't know how to do this. However, look at my traits. I'm the ideal ambassador. Right. It's really something else. He does this also with one of my favorite things he does is in his passages on virtue, like the Roman quality of, you know, virtus, the manly virtues of political action. He'll say, you know, and of course, if you're going to argue that you are going to be an effective political actor, that's like the quality that you would have is this: you have this sort of political virtues of you know, courage, temperance, justice, etc., and you have this inherent drive to work towards the public good. Mm-hmm. And this has to be deeply habituated to be effective. And so we'll say things like, well, you know, the most virtuoso people, political actors we know, you know, Socrates was willing to die for Athens, or Cato the Younger, who literally pulls his own entrails out in resistance to Caesar's tyranny. Yeah. You know, these are the most virtuoso you know, people in the world. And I'm nothing like those people. You know, my virtue is just, it's like it naturally came to me. I inherited as if with my nurse's milk, he says. Mm-hmm. It's like a deeply ingrained set of habits and customs. And then you start looking, it's like, oh, actually, no, you know what? All of the Renaissance literature that talks about the people who have the most virtue, and Montaigne himself says this all over the place, is like, oh, what makes Socrates so great? Oh, what makes Cato so great is that they have this deeply ingrained habit of these virtuoso habits. And so Montaigne says, I'm not like those guys. But then he goes around, and what's he actually doing? He's comparing himself to Socrates and Cato. Like, he's saying, I'm kind of like those guys. So it's subtle. It's hilarious once you see it because it's, it's pretty, it's funny.
It's really endearing. It's really endearing. Sticking with the political theme, if I may, a term of yours, radical moderation. I like the sound of it. What is it and how does Montaigne embody it or display it?
Yes, it's a term that I wrestle with because it's very paradoxical, and very by complete coincidence. I think a few months before my book came out, Aurelian Creutu came out also with a book, and his last chapter in his book is also called Radical Moderation.
Okay.
I, you know, we had no communication about this. He contacted me when my book came out and say, "What? Wow, what a coincidence! Like, look, we both did the same thing at the same time." You know, and I was building on actually some of his earlier work on moderation, too, again explicitly, and so so. To frame it in broader terms, you know, one of the things that Montaigne's doing, I think, and one of the things I argue in the book, is that by the time we get to these later editions of the essays, and he's already, you know, and one important aspect of the book is him building on these political genres of advice books, and now he's building on this very new but you know, growing political genre of books on how to train ambassadors and what's the ideal, you know, actions and behavior and character of the ideal ambassador. So he starts, you know, referring to some of his own work in conversation with that. And because he knows now, and he says explicitly over and over again, this is a public book now. People are reading this. I've got a large readership. I'm writing for a whole public now, not just for myself or not just for my friends or not just for the king, you know, to get a job. that so he's advertising this, right? These are the traits of a good ambassador are traits that in this war-torn moment, like ordinary people, and ordinary people are reading his book. Literacy rates are incredibly low, but it's not just other noblemen reading this book, that too. But it's, you know, lower level scholars. He knows he has, you know, women are reading his book, obviously, like, you know, a more upper class women, merchants are, you know, are reading his book. So he has a, you know, as public a readership as you can have at the time. And so he's advertising these traits. Like these are traits that ordinary people not only can take on, but must take on, because, you know, we often think today of toleration or tolerance as, you know, a high philosophical value or a value to be embedded in constitutional law and you know, centralized institutions. But, you know, when you're trying to come out of a period of civil war and civil conflict, the most important work is going to happen like at the village level. How do you go to the marketplace every week and buy and sell your products, which is absolutely essential for people eating, you know, in that village? In the stall next to a Protestant, if you're a Catholic, or a Catholic, if you're a Protestant, you know, you may have been involved in battles against each other. You may have known someone who tortured someone to death, because that happens during those kinds of conflicts. How do you rebuild that social fabric, not just at the highest levels of government, which is obviously important too, and actually the Edict of Nantes, the Edict of Toleration that's often promulgated by Henry IV towards limited freedom of worship for Protestants. You know, we often think of that as like a royal decree that then is obeyed, and this is what ends the French Wars of Religion. In the run-up to writing that decree, there's intensive negotiations between Catholics and Protestants. Montaigne is probably involved in some of those, you know, possibly trying to convince Henry IV, whom he knows well at this point, you know, to convert to Catholicism, to hold the kingdom together. So the Edict of Nantes itself is the result of a negotiated settlement. And then in order to promulgate this edict, and you know, they don't have, you know, cable news and the internet to get information out. They actually have, as part of the edict, they have provisions for local kind of courts of arbitration or local arbitration hearings to try to negotiate how the settlement's going to play out at the local level. So even the high-end laws have, down to the local level, provisions for negotiating civil peace. And so here's Montaigne writing effectively, by the time you get to the later editions, a kind of handbook for how do we ordinary folks, you know, down at the village level, in the stalls at the local market, you know, how do we figure out how to talk to each other again, and how to, you know, negotiate how to stay out of each other's hair enough to repair enough of the social fabric, not perfectly, but enough that we can stop, you know, killing each other, and so we can move on. And that's a tremendously important question, you know, in our time as well as his. Right, think of the conflicts in American politics. If we're lucky enough that some of these deeper conflicts that have all kinds of armed threats behind them in American civil life, you know, at some point we're going to have to figure out how to live together again in workplaces and neighborhoods. And, these skills could be important. And so your question is about moderation. So one of the skills that Montaigne touts as leading to his successful, brief career as a political negotiator is a kind of moderation. And it's a paradoxical form of moderation because he puts it in terms of the role of the ambassador in, I think, direct, conversation with some existing works on this, that, well, a negotiator for a prince has these weird two roles that are in tension with each other. On the one hand, the ambassador or the negotiator is a representative of the prince, and so is sent out as a kind of a delegate, of what the prince wants. At the same time, the ambassador is a go-between. Between two princes, who's actually working for the larger goal of peace between them. Mm-hmm. And so you have this responsibility for peace between two warring camps or two princes, and on the other hand, you're a representative of one of the sides. And so Montaigne, the way he puts this is that he's a committed royalist Catholic. He's not part of the hardline Catholic League, one of the sort of parties that comes up during this time, but he has a partisan. Very strongly felt partisan position. And yet he also has to act as a go-between between these. And so how do you moderate your partisan passions enough that you can go do this work out here? In order to moderate those passions, you're also representing a side. So you have to hold on to those passions. Mm-hmm. And so the moderation is radical in the sense that you're doing this delicate balance where you're very much explicitly, honestly, he says, you can only negotiate if you're very honest about your own partisan commitments here. You're holding on to your own partisan, not just the stuff that you want, but the passions involved in it. You love your side, you hate the other side. Mm-hmm. How do you hold on to that? Keep that passion going while making sure that it doesn't overwhelm your capacity to act as a go-between at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so it's a moderation, but it's a moderation that doesn't get rid of those passions. It actually helps to kind of stoke them and make them possible at the same time. And his analogy, because he's a 16th century Frenchman, he uses the analogy of sexual moderation at various other times in the book. And so he invites us, he's a thought experiment, and if I'm permitted to talk about such matters on a podcast, he has a thought experiment where he invites people to imagine a perpetual, lifelong, unending orgasm. And he says, sexual pleasure is pleasure, but this form of sexual pleasure would be hell. I mean, it would be unbearable. And so just as your the enjoyment of your political passions has to have a sort of connection with the extremes still, because you've got to be a partisan, otherwise you can't do this. Yeah. But at the same time, you have to somehow make yourself able to talk to the other side. Right. Other forms of moderation are like this too, where you have to reduce the pleasure in order to feel it to its fullest extent. And this sort of this tension, there, he says moderation is more difficult than non-moderation, because your moderation is paradoxical in that you're forcing yourself to still feel those passions, whether it's pleasure or partisanship. And yet you're going into the breach, and you're still have to deal with lessening them while stoking them. It's psychologically difficult, he says.
Yeah. You notice that the first published use of public reason is Montaigne's.
Yes, that I've been able to find. Yeah.
That's really neat. What does he mean by it? And does it, just to make a political theory nerd question, does it mean something different now?
Yes. And so public reason, made famous by John Rawls, is a, it's in the hands of someone like Rawls means a set of kind of speech rules, moral rules, not like legal rules, but a set of moral rules that we should, ought to impose on ourselves when we are arguing, matters of basic liberty or matters of intense conflict with other people. So if we're giving reasons, gives an example of the Supreme Court and says that, you know, Supreme Court justices ought to, for example, when arguing for a case, or if you're a lawyer before the Supreme Court arguing for this or that decision in a case, you have a moral duty, again, not a legal duty, but a moral duty to argue in terms that the other side can understand and can accept. Even if they don't agree with it, they might say no, like they might decide against you, but they can accept your reasons as reasons that they could understand. And he's thinking about religion specifically. So if you're an atheist, you wouldn't want to be arguing matters of basic liberty with a committed, you know, a religious person by saying, well, my argument stems from the fact that there is no God, because that's a reason that a religious person can't accept, and vice versa. You wouldn't want to, if you're a Christian arguing with non-Christians, you wouldn't want to say, well, we have to have this law because Jesus Christ, the Son of God, says, right? Yeah. Like the your Jewish people, atheists, everybody else is like, well, I can't accept that. Yeah. And another formulation is that we must give each other justifications for our positions that that no one could reasonably reject. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's often used as a kind of trump card. Like if you just say reasonable, it'll like answer all the questions. And like I don't fully understand these kinds of arguments. Yeah. People really like them, and I don't fully grasp it. I think because I'm too Montanian. Montanian be like, well, I can argue that anything's reasonable. Watch,
sure.
You know, yeah. Yeah. So when he talks about public reason, he talks about public reason as being attached to more concretely to practices and institutions that are often like customary in nature, but that hold together basic stability and peace, but in a very society marked by a multiplicity of different ways of living, which already France is at this point, and so that's public reason. Am I arguing in such a way that I'm repairing and helping those kinds of institutions along, or am I arguing in such a way that I'm not? Because we do have some shared goods, despite our disagreements. People have a shared, in most societies, certainly have a shared orientation towards public goods of basic peace and stability. It's not good for anybody for there to be a civil war. It destroys all economic activity. It destroys people's morals. People torture each other during these times. Right. That's how we should, in much more practical institutional, activity terms. That's how we should think about this concept.
Yeah. Okay. This is very helpful to me. As we come to a close, I just want to ask you a simple question. Do you teach Montaigne?
I do. And this is a really great question. He's one of the most, because of the form of his text and because of his argumentation form, he's one of the hardest books to teach to undergraduates because, how do you handle all of those digressions? Yeah. He's very much in like a historical milieu we in the United States, for example, students don't learn much about that. He's taught a lot in France, but students, by the time they get to Montaigne, have all this background knowledge that make him make sense a lot more. We don't have that as much. So what I do, and I can only speak to my own practice here, and it does seem to be pretty effective, is that I bring him in, I bring limited parts of some of his chapters in to talk about larger, in conjunction with other texts, to talk about larger themes in the history of political ideas. So I also teach, in a much more historical, my classes are often history classes built around historical texts than they are philosophical classes. So I think a philosophy class would look different. But for example, if I'm teaching a modern political theory class, one of the most important modern political ideas that comes up is how do you manage disagreement between groups of different religious believers? So, how does religious toleration, come about? And so when we're talking about this, I'll bring in a number of different texts, and I can kind of think of who I pair him with at this point. But for example, I'll bring in Montaigne's relatively easy to understand chapter of freedom of conscience. Uh-huh. And he'll talk about, again, policies of extending. He doesn't use the word toleration, I should also add. And that's a later use of that word. He'll talk about liberté de conscience and other words. But he is talking about policies of limited freedom to worship of different, you know, religious groups. Right. And, you know, so if you put sort of bite-sized pieces of him as almost a supplement to talk about the development of certain kinds of ideas. Mm-hmm. On cannibals is also a really useful and well-read passage at this point. And it's for a reason, right? It's a really great passage. So we talk about, you know, what are modern political ideas? What is the modern world versus pre? Well, one of the features certainly is when the trans Eurasian trade zone built on the Silk Road and Indian Ocean, commercial traffic, when that jumps to the Americas by accident because Columbus is trying to get around the Ottoman Empire towards China and India and discovers, oh my goodness, there's a giant landmass in the middle of these things. Yeah, let's violently colonize it and make money that way instead. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Then the Portuguese get involved, the English get involved, et cetera, et cetera. So when you're teaching about that, I find it's really important to read some, to read some Cortez, like read the, mm-hmm. how horrible some of these, actions and people were. Cortez, the killer, as Neil Young calls him. And then read some Las Casas and some Montaigne to talk about, there were critics of this violence at the time saying this is morally wrong.
Yeah.
And Montaigne, is an interesting person there. Because the other thing I should say, as we close is, there are definitive positions that Montaigne takes. And so he does say that violence and cruelty for political gain or for any other reason is just simply wrong. The cruelty, that's the basis of his moral belief, it seems. Another thing I find very appealing about him is he doesn't come up with a whole bunch of philosophical arguments about why cruelty is wrong, because that in itself is sort of inhuman.
Yeah.
Like we should be, as he puts it, we should be like physically repulsed by cruelty. If people are torturing other people for their own pleasure or for their own gain somehow, like that should disgust us. You don't need to have reasons that nobody could reasonably reject. Like that's a cold, weird way of trying to convey that idea, and that's a very definitive position that Moulton takes on throughout the essays. Again, another reason for his appeal, I think, that humaneness, that sort of creaturely. You know, the human animal is being harmed in this way that hurts me when I think about it or see it. And like, it should hurt you when you think about it or see it. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's another part of his appeal.
I think that's absolutely worth mentioning as we close that, Montaigne may be all over the place. He may be a yes-sayer and a both-and sort of philosopher, if you want to call him a philosopher. But he's emphatically anti-cruelty.
Yes.
There's just two ways about it. He doesn't need to build a system to be anti-cruelty.
Right. Exactly. It's, and in fact, building a system, it takes away some of that. You lose some of the important insights about why cruelty is wrong if you do it through cold philosophical reasoning.
Yeah.
You don't need justifications for this. In that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and this could well be, it's just occurring to me now, I keep saying we're going to close, but I'm adding trains to the car here.
How Montaigne
cars to the train here. Yeah, right? Yeah. One more thing. No, I should stop. It occurs to me as we're speaking that the first thing I read was the Cannibals essay, and that's because Rousseau alluded to it.
Yes.
And so he came to me immediately as the anti-cruelty thinker. Mm-hmm. So I was very glad for you to close with that as in a personal aside. From another vat.
Yeah, that from another vat, exactly. And just to add another allongée to the argument, and you can find those tidbits throughout almost every prominent, at least European, you know, writer. There's lots of other really interesting thought that's happening at the same time in China, India, Africa. You know, there's a lot, all kinds of interesting global political theory that is interesting also to put him in conversation with. But you know, at least in terms of European thinkers, initially, you know, he you can find his fingerprints on everybody. It's not just French thinkers like Pascal and Descartes, which we know about, but the later French thinkers, French Francophone thinkers anyway, Rousseau, for example, Montesquieu. But you know, you find him right away in English thinkers like Hobbes never says so explicitly, but we know he was hanging out in Paris with giant Montaigne fans like Naudet and La Motte Le Veillé. Into Leviathan, he inserts a whole new chapter on the on the difference in manners, by which he means customs. That's like the most Montaignean theme you could possibly write in there. And he comes up with these big funny lists of people's beliefs. Well, guess who else does that? Montaigne does that. I can see Montaigne's text in Leviathan. John Locke, what's one of Locke's biggest questions in the essay concerning human understanding? Well, it's like, well, how do we cleanse our thought processes of merely customary beliefs? Well, guess who brings that into public consciousness as like a main political question? And we know Locke, you know, on record says, yes, I read Montaigne. Of course I do. Kant reads Montaigne. Like all of these thinkers, Montaigne's sort of like the hidden architecture of so much of what we consider to be like modern political ideas. He's all over it. Sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly. Like Kant is such a completely different thinker from Montaigne, but he reportedly had the essays on his bedside table to read for fun. And you could say this about a number of different thinkers as well.
So I promise we're stopping, but Montaigne manages to avoid the censors throughout his life, right? But he does eventually end up on the index. Am I right about this?
He does, maybe
100 years later or something like this. Is this because of the thinkers who took him up, would you say, or did the church just have a second thought, or how did this work?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think it is that, right? So Montaigne is, you know, it's often debated, and this happens a lot with thinkers, especially those who are relatively heterodox. You know, is Montaigne secretly an atheist or not? And, as with so many questions in Montaigne, there's a number of arguments that could be made. And he ends up actually when the first edition comes out, and he mentions this in later editions, the papal censors took issue with his ubiquitous references to fortuna, to fortune and chance, because this sounds like you're denying divine providence. But he never takes it again, doesn't erase anything, so he keeps them right in there when he keeps writing. And he's, you know, I think well thought of enough, and the book is kind of, you know, there's so much stuff in there that there's that he doesn't get banned yet, but he does get banned in subsequent years. And I think it's because of his skepticism and his really idiosyncratic religious beliefs, at least as he expresses them in the book. So his mother, Antoinette de Loupe, is a from a prominent Murano family, that is to say a Jewish family that had escaped the Inquisition in Spain. And Spain is like, you know, right there across the Pyrenees where he lives. And interesting, his the way that he depicts God, he's a very, you know, committed Catholic thinker by my reading, and he certainly portrays himself as that. But the way he talks about God is much more a Jewish God than a Catholic God. You can't know God. God is unknowable. The attributes of God, God's will, they are not knowable to human beings. And he says this repeatedly and over and over and over again. So one of the reasons why he's a committed Catholic is because he was raised Catholic. And so his puny human mind could never, ever possibly conceive of what God actually wants in terms of our religious practices. So why not stick to the customary ones you were raised with? Because there's no possible human reason to get out of them because you just can't know what the attributes of God are. There's no afterlife in Montaigne. He says repeatedly, you know, the famous, you know, and again, another really well-read, often read essay is to philosophize is to learn how to die. And Montaigne says repeatedly, you know, I think about death. I train myself to get used to death so that I can live, so that I can be lost. I can be, get rid of this fear of death so I can have a more abundant life, you know, here on earth. Part of that argument, and this comes up over and over again throughout the essays, is we don't know what happens to us when we die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it worse? Is it better? You have no idea. So why would we ruin potentially our only time here on this earth through this crippling fear of death? Well, the Catholic Church at this time, and then the Protestant churches at this time, have a lot to say about what happens to us after we die. And so that's not how Christians talk about the afterlife. That like you don't know what's out there, right? That's also again closer to, in some ways to Jewish different versions. Is also Judaism is of course incredibly buried as well than is now. Ask 10 rabbis what the afterlife is like, and you'll get 10 different responses. There's not a defined, single defined doctrine about that as there is in some Christian churches.
Right. Well, before I get myself in any deeper, let me just say thanks so much to Douglas Thompson for joining me on Pod Opticon today. It's been a lot of fun for me.
Oh, thank you so much, Randall. I'm a longtime fan of the show, and it's a real pleasure to have a chance to talk with you today.
That means a lot.
And I love talking about Montaigne.
Oh, man, we'll have to do it again because I obviously can't shut up. All right, my friend. Thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, as always, for listening. I hope you'll join me next time. Until then.